This is Kindergarten Cop, and I will be reading from the Decatur Herald and Review. This is November 24, 2025. This article is titled "Ukraine and Western Allies Meet in Geneva to Discuss U.S. Peace Plan" by Mark Carlson and Katie Marie Davies. Top European and Ukrainian envoys conferred Sunday in Geneva ahead of talks with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio over President Donald Trump's proposal to end Russia's war on Ukraine. The head of the Ukrainian delegation, Presidential Chief of Staff Andriy Yermak, wrote on social media that they held their first meeting with the national security advisors from the UK, France, and Germany. The Allies have rallied around Kiev in a push to revise the plan, which is seen as favoring Moscow. The next meeting is with the U.S. delegation. "We are in a very constructive mood," Yermak said. "We continue working together to achieve a lasting and just peace for Ukraine." Rubio was expected to join the talks together with Army Secretary Dan Driscoll and Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff. Before the meeting, Trump used a lengthy online post Sunday to blast Ukraine for a lack of gratitude for U.S. military assistance, while notably shying away from criticizing Russia. "With strong and proper U.S. and Ukrainian leadership," Trump wrote, "Russia's invasion of Ukraine would have never happened." Trump also took a swipe at U.S. allies in Europe, writing, in all caps, "Ukraine leadership has expressed zero gratitude for our efforts, and Europe continues to buy oil from Russia." Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he was waiting for the outcome of the talks. "A positive result is needed for all of us," he said. Ukrainian and American teams of our European partners are in close contact, and I very much hope there will be a result. "Bloodshed must be stopped, and it must be guaranteed that the war will not be reignited," he wrote Sunday in a post on Telegram. In a later post, Zelensky said there was an understanding the U.S. would take into account, quote, "a number of elements in a peace deal that are important for Ukraine," but did not elaborate further. There have already been brief reports from the team about the results of the first meetings and conversations, he said. "There is now an understanding that the American proposals may take into account a number of elements based on the Ukrainian vision and are critically important for Ukraine's national interests." Rustem Umerov, Secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council and a member of Ukraine's Geneva delegation, wrote that although the peace plan proposals were still being finalized, they included, quote, "many Ukrainian priorities." "We appreciate our American partners working closely with us to understand our concerns to reach this critical point, and we expect to make more progress today," he said. The 28-point blueprint drawn up by the U.S. to end the nearly four-year war sparked alarm in Kiev and European capitals. Zelensky has said his country could face a stark choice between standing up for its sovereign rights and preserving the American support it needs. The proposal, originating from negotiations between Washington and Moscow, acquiesces to many Russian demands that Zelensky has categorically rejected on dozens of occasions, including giving up large pieces of territory. The Ukrainian leader vowed that his people, quote, "will always defend their home." Speaking before Sunday's talks, Elise Ruffo, France's minister delegate at the Defense Ministry, told broadcaster France Info that key points of discussion would include the plan's restrictions on the Ukrainian army, which she described as a limitation on its sovereignty. "Ukraine must be able to defend itself," she said. "Russia wants war and waged war many times, in fact, over the past years." Speaking to reporters Saturday outside the White House, Trump said the U.S. proposal was not his final offer. "I would like to get to peace. It should have happened a long time ago. The Ukraine war with Russia should never have happened," Trump said. One way or the other, we have to get it ended. Trump didn't explain what he meant by the plan not being his final offer, and the White House didn't respond to a request for clarification. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk said Sunday that Warsaw was ready to work on the plan with the leaders of Europe, Canada, and Japan, but also said that it would be good to know for sure who is the author of the plan and where it was created. Some U.S. lawmakers said Saturday that Rubio described the plan as a Russian, quote, wish list, rather than a Washington-led proposal. The bipartisan group of senators told a news conference that they spoke to Rubio about the peace plan after he reached out to some of them while on his way to Geneva. Independent Maine Senator Angus King said Rubio told them the plan, quote, was not the administration's plan, but a, quote, wish list of the Russians. A State Department spokesperson denied their account, calling it, quote, blatantly false. Rubio himself then took the extraordinary step of suggesting online that the senators were mistaken, even though they said he was their source for the information. The Secretary of State doubled down on the assertion that Washington was responsible for a proposal that had surprised many from the beginning for being so favorable to Moscow. On Sunday, the top Democrat on the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee said the peace plan appeared to be, quote, almost a series of Russian talking points, and had Europeans, quote, feel like they've been totally left high and dry, and had led to, quote, ferocious pushback. U.S. Senator Mark Warner told ABC's This Week that he thought Trump was, quote, seeing this one-sided plan kind of blow up in his face. My hope is he'll come back and be a bit more reasonable, Warner said. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced that he would hold a phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Monday. He said he would talk to the Russian leader about reviving a previous deal from July 2022 that allowed Ukraine to safely ship exports of grain via the Black Sea. The agreement stayed in place until the following year, when Putin refused to extend it, saying that a parallel agreement promising to remove obstacles to Russian exports of food and fertilizer hadn't been honored. Quote, we had a grain corridor endeavor to open the path to peace, Erdogan said. Unfortunately, we were only partially able to succeed. Tomorrow, I will be asking Putin to revisit the endeavor. This article is titled, Teen Takeover Yields Senseless Violence. 14-year-old killed, 18s hurt in downtown chaos, by Carolyn Kubzanski, Jake Sheridan, Rebecca Johnson of the Chicago Tribune. As thousands gathered at Chicago's Millennium Park on Friday evening for the annual tree lighting ceremony, social media posts advertising the latest and what would become perhaps the deadliest, quote, teen takeover continued to spread online. In mere hours, the holiday cheer turned into chaos. A 14-year-old boy was killed and 8 other teenagers were injured in a pair of shootings that Mayor Brandon Johnson called acts of, quote, senseless violence. It had also led to renewed calls from aldermen to implement policies that deter similar large gatherings in the Loop. No suspects were in custody in either shooting Saturday. No parent wants to get that terrible, life-altering call, Johnson said Saturday morning at an unrelated event on the West Side. It is senseless violence like these shootings that make us all feel unsafe, and it has left too many families in Chicago reeling. The first shooting happened just before 10 p.m. outside the Chicago Theater in the 100th block of North State Street, according to Chicago police. An unidentified suspect walked away from a brawl that had broken out on the sidewalk, according to a police report. He then took out a gun and fired into a crowd of teenagers, wounding 7 of them. Officers on patrol heard the gunshots and saw a large group running. They later recovered 3 9mm casings from the scene of the shooting, the police report stated. The victims, who ranged in age from 13 to 17 and came from all over the Chicago area, were transported to Lurie Children's Hospital, Northwestern Memorial Hospital, and Stroger Hospital in good and fair conditions. Some had graze wounds on their stomach and hips, while others had gunshot wounds on their legs. Less than an hour later, officers also found two other teens with gunshot wounds lying in the street in the 100th block of South Dearborn Street. Video footage of the shooting shows several large crowds roaming the street before abruptly scattering, according to a police report. Police recovered three more 9mm casings, one live round, and a fired bullet from the area. An 18-year-old man who was shot in the leg was taken to Northwestern in serious condition, police said. A 14-year-old boy was shot multiple times and was pronounced dead less than an hour later at the same hospital. His identity hadn't been made public as of Saturday afternoon, and his family couldn't be contacted at their Southside home. On Saturday, Johnson called the downtown violence a, quote, setback that was a reminder of, quote, the long road that we have to build the city that we all want to live in. He said there would be a, quote, strong police presence for the Wintrust Magnificent Mile Lights Festival set for Saturday evening. National attention. Chicago crime has become a national issue, as President Donald Trump has criticized urban crime and even attempted to take credit for recent dips in the crime rate as part of his Operation Midway Blitz immigration raids that have been winding down. This week, Johnson sought to head off concerns about public transit safety after a man was charged with setting a woman on fire on a CTA Blue Line train. Of course, the Trump administration is going to continue to try to take credit for our positive work, Johnson said, of decreases in the violent crime rate. Our law enforcement has done a solid job working with all of our partners to bring down violence in the city of Chicago. The last shooting with such a high number of victims in the center of the city was at drill rapper Mello Bucks' album release party in the North River neighborhood in July. Four people were killed and 14 wounded in the drive-by rifle shooting. A teen takeover downtown. Sources said both Friday night shootings were connected to a, quote, teen takeover that had made the rounds on social media over the past few days. Police reports indicate that teens from as far away as Dalton and Evanston traveled downtown for the gathering after the tree lighting ceremony. Some social media videos warned people to avoid the loop due to the possible takeover. Johnson said young people need to understand that they should not attend these unauthorized events that have been advertised on social media, and called on parents to accompany their children at large events like the tree lighting. Police made 18 arrests, he said, and recovered 5 guns while responding to the shootings. He said the city had sent a communication through Chicago Public Schools telling students not to participate in the gathering, and that 700 additional police officers were deployed downtown Friday night. A CPD spokesperson declined to comment on the number of deployed officers in the loop, citing operational security concerns. But clearly, what we put in place did not do enough to prevent what we were concerned about from actually manifesting, Johnson said. Hundreds of young adults have attended what we are now commonly called teen takeovers over the past few years in the city's downtown neighborhoods. Notable gatherings in March, including one that ended with a 15-year-old boy sustaining a graze wound and another with a tourist being shot as she walked back to a hotel with her son, generated debate in the city council and neighborhood groups alike over teen curfews. Around that time, Alderman Brian Hopkins, 2nd Ward, revived his push for an 8 p.m. downtown curfew on unaccompanied minors, which is 2 hours earlier than the long-standing citywide 10 p.m. teen curfew. Johnson tentatively pushed back on the effort, but the Streeterville alderman eventually got it passed by a city council majority in June. It was set to give the police superintendent the authority to declare teen curfews anytime, anywhere, with little required notice. But in July, Johnson issued a rare mayoral veto to block the ordinance. He derided the measure as, quote, political theater, and said instead that the city is, quote, investing in people. The mayor has sought to ramp up spending on programs like youth summer jobs and community violence intervention work. Chicago has seen sharp drops in homicides and shootings, both down around 30% compared with the same point last year. The easy thing to do would be to tell people that if we threaten young people and families with severe repercussions, that somehow will make us safer, Johnson said in July. But we know from years of doing the same old tired forms of policy that it doesn't get the results that people have longed for. It doesn't keep us safe. Johnson did not address the curfew ordinance on Saturday, but Alderman Bill Conway, 34th, whose ward includes the location of the second shooting, told the Tribune that a curfew, quote, would have been another tool that perhaps could have been useful. Kids should obviously be able to go downtown without fear of being shot, and we need to make sure that police have the resources they need to fight and deter crime, Conway said. Alderman Brendan Riley, whose 42nd ward includes the Chicago Theater, shared a more forceful call for the curfew power blocked by Johnson. It, quote, sure would have come in handy when hundreds of police on the scene noticed young crowds, quote, acting up before the first shooting, he said. It is incredibly disappointing the mayor decided to veto that ordinance based purely on ideology and politics, he said. Riley said he fears the shooting could hurt businesses as downtown's critical holiday retail season begins. We depend very heavily upon our sales tax, and so we need to make sure that people are confident that they're going to be safe when they're going downtown during the holidays, he said. These headlines sting. This is an article titled Woven Together. Study reveals secret of super web. It is shared by two species of spiders, by Stephen McGrath. What is thought to be the world's largest known spider's web, housing tens of thousands of arachnids, was discovered in a cave on the Albanian-Greek border. The most surprising thing about the spider colony, which boasts an estimated 110,000 spiders, had less to do with its size and more to do with what scientists found inside the huge mass of funnel-shaped webs. After researchers published their findings of two spider species peacefully cohabitating in a giant colony nestled in a pitch-black, sulfur-rich cave, evolutionary biologist Dr. Lena Grinstead likened the extremely rare occurrence to humans living in an apartment block. The results of the study, published last month in the journal Subterranean Biology, spread rapidly online due to the striking images of the giant 1,140-square-foot web, a carpet-thick sprawl stretching along a narrow passage wall inside Sulfur Cave, which extends into Albania from its entrance in Greece. The two spider species, about 69,000 Tegenaria domestica, or common house spider, and 42,000 Prinergon vagans, were living side by side and thriving. The behavior, never observed before, stunned scientists, as typically the larger house spider would prey on its smaller neighbor. So often, if you have spiders in close vicinity, they will fight and end up eating each other, said Grinstead, a senior lecturer at the UK's University of Portsmouth, who extensively researched spiders but was not part of the study. We can sometimes see that if there's an abundance of food, that they sort of become a bit less aggressive. Abundant food. Scientists are keen to understand how and why the two species came to coexist peacefully in, quote, a permanent dark zone about 164 feet from the entrance of the cave, carved out by the waters of the Serendiporo River to form the Vrominer Canyon. Part of the answer, the research suggests, may lie in the combination of the estimated 2.4 million midge flies that buzz around the spider colony and, quote, unusually dense swarm that provides a constant food source in an otherwise predator-scarce environment. The scientists also speculate that the friendly living arrangement could be a result of darkness impairing the spider's vision. Grinstead says it is more likely that the larger spiders evolved or simply grew accustomed to responding to vibratory cues when the small flies land on their silken web and maybe don't attack otherwise. Spiders in general are not particularly good at seeing stuff, and that includes these two species, she said. She added that the two species might cooperate to some extent in building the web, but I think it's highly unlikely that they cooperate in anything else, like prey capture, in brood care, or looking after each other's babies. She added that while many spiders are typically solitary, very aggressive toward each critters, the cohabitation of two species is, quote, relatively common once spiders evolved an ability to live in groups. But again, because these two species have never been found to live together and never been found to live in groups, it makes it particularly exciting, she said. Ideal environment. Dr. Blarina Vrnosi, a biologist and zoologist at the University of Tirana in Albania, who co-authored the research paper, said the expeditions this year helped understand how this mystery existed in there. The DNA is interesting because they revealed that the species which lives inside the cave is different from the one which lives outside the cave, she said. So it's the same species, but different DNA. The cave colony's giant web was first observed in 2021 by a team of Czech speleologists led by Marek Audi. A year later, the Czech team expanded to include scientists from multiple universities, which led to the recent paper. The web is dense. It's more like a blanket, and when there's danger, the female crawls back and hides, and no creature of a higher order can dig her out of there, Audi said. Spiders in the cave lay about a third of the eggs compared to spiders that live outdoors. Because it's certain that they will raise their offspring there so they can afford to lay fewer eggs. Audi added that the cave is also home to large bat colonies, which also thrive on the abundant midges. They are constantly having a party there, both the spiders and the bats, he said. The study noted that the methodology used might, quote, slightly overestimate the total population count of spiders in the colony, as some funnel webs may be abandoned or unoccupied. However, other experts agree that the team's exciting new research could offer broader evolutionary clues and deserves deeper study. This is an article on gardening, Go for Indigo, by Norman Winter. 5 years ago, I introduced the garden reader to the little indigo that could. That little indigo, named Supertunia mini vista indigo, is still doing it. Supertunia mini vista indigo petunia, winner of 34 awards, can now add another trophy to the case. It has been designated a Louisiana superplant, standing right next to the granddaddy of them all, the Supertunia vista bubblegum petunia. The Louisiana superplant list reads like the fine gardening book. these are the plants to grow in Louisiana. Obviously, this list would be sage advice for a lot of other states, too. There is one other thing about this list, and it stands out like a bolt of lightning. The Louisiana Superplant List has the Supertunia Mini Vista Indigo Petunia and the Supertunia Vista Bubblegum Petunia under cool season annuals blooming 7 months, November through May. Louisiana USDA plant hardiness zones range from 8A to 10A. Don't let that throw you, as they are talking to the entire state about enjoying Supertunia November through May. If you've been reading my columns or following on Facebook, you know the garden guy is a fan of painting all the supers in the fall in zone 8 and warmer. I'm talking about Supertunia petunias, Superbells, Calabrachios, Superbena verbenas. I grew the Supertunia vistas in the ground from November through July when I realized my landscape in West Georgia was like Yellowstone with the deer population. My neighbor saw 10 in my yard recently. To me, I would like the opportunity to buy the Supertunias for planting in the spring and then as needed in September and October too in zones 8 and warmer. You most likely realize that Supertunia Vista Bubblegum is like the all-time award winner, and I can assure you that the Supertunia Mini Vista Indigo can hang with it. I've watched it thrive in the hottest summers in Georgia and Alabama. Supertunia Mini Vista petunias will reach 6 to 12 inches tall and spread up to 24 inches. They will exceed all expectations whether planted in raised beds or mixed containers. Notice I said raised beds. The arch enemies of all petunias are tight compacted clay and poor internal drainage. Raised bed soils and amendments and good lighting, good lightweight potting soils with plenty of sun will make you an award winner too. Susan Middleton Turner in Zone 9, Miller County, Georgia, gets my vote for award winner as she uses Supertunia Mini Vista Indigo Petunias in coconut banister baskets along the front of her home in a spectacular monoculture application. Young's Plant Farm Annual Garden Tour in Auburn, Alabama used them at the front of a raised bed with Rudbeckias, Vinca, and Guara showing how blue enhances all other colors. At the Garden Guy's house, the second week of November, the Supertunia Mini Indigo was creating a dynamic complementary color scheme with luscious marmalade lantana and Superbell's tangerine punch Calabrachoa. If you are in zone 8 and warmer and can try a fall planting of Supertunia Mini Vista Indigo or Supertunia Vista Bubblegum, jump on board. No matter where you live, though, spring will be here before you know it. So now is a great time to cozy up to the fireplace and plan your flower beds and mixed containers.